Action Park Media.
And welcome back to Victory the Podcast. I'm Doug Ellen.
I'm Kevin Dillon.
Victory!
Nice. So we are going to talk episode 5, season 1, The Script and the Sherpa, which to this day is a lot of people's favorite episode. They still talk to me about it all the time online and people when I talk to. And there's people who actually don't even know that that was Val Kilmer, which I find amazing.
It's crazy.
That's how good he is, you know? Yeah. And Kevin Connelly, he's quiet in the booth.
He was probably our biggest cameo to date, though.
Not cameo.
I still think it's a cameo.
But it wasn't a cameo because he didn't want to play himself. He really, really wanted to be a character as opposed to James Woods.
But you could be a cameo and you don't have to play yourself.
But also a cameo is like the lead of the episode, you know?
Yeah, it might have been bigger than a cameo.
I don't know. We got to look up the exact definition of cameo. Isn't it playing yourself? But anyway.
No, it's not. Okay. No, it's just playing, doing a small little bit.
Right. All right. Interesting.
I think so too.
Yeah. We are Googling that. A small character part in a play or a movie played by a distinguished actor or celebrity.
Kevin Dillon is
the winner.
Okay. Kevin Dillon.
Victory.
But what I'll say, it definitely wasn't a small part. It was a big part.
No, it was a big part of the episode. And it got bigger and bigger too, because he added a lot to it.
Well, also, I don't know if you guys remember this, but when he was doing that one scene, he had his lines plastered all over the ceiling. So it would look like he was taking these dramatic beats in character, but he was trying to remember his lines.
Well, first of all, it was like a two-page monologue. It was massive.
And by the way, Larry Charles wrote that monologue. He wrote it on a cocktail napkin. It was pretty amazing. Afterthought on that episode, which is I'm sitting about 7 months later, I'm sitting at Matsuisha, great sushi restaurant in LA, and I'm with a bunch of friends, and Val Kilmer is sitting about 4 tables away. And everybody's like, yo, it's Val, it's your boy, go say hello, which everyone thinks because they were on the show that I'm supposed to be best friends with all these movie stars and stuff. But, you know, I'm like, he probably doesn't even know who I am. We worked together for one day. It was 6 months ago. Val gets up and he comes over to me. I'm like waiting for, you know, him to what he wants. But he's like, hey, Doug, I didn't get to see the episode yet. But Bo, she never called me back. What's up with that? Okay.
Well, backstory on that. Bo Garrett
is the beautiful woman on this show.
Plays like
this
the episode. Vegan sort of
the vegan
earthy.
Hippie girl.
Now, backstory. Adrian and her, they went on to date. Adrian liked her a lot. That was a real thing. That wasn't like a fling. Adrian really liked her. He had feelings for her. I mean, I think...
As did Val.
Not set feelings, you're saying.
That it was a real thing for Adrian. Yeah. So, but Val Kilmer was like, said to Jerry and I, which is, Jerry and I were recapping the story. It's hilarious. Again, we're outside smoking and Val Kilmer's like, this guy's a fucking asshole. He keeps fucking cock blocking me. This guy won't stop cock blocking me. We're like, who? He's like, this guy. Adrian? Is one of the stars of the show? Oh, that guy? It was like life imitating art. They were going head to head for this girl. You know?
I mean, that is an amazing story. Watching it again last night, it really flies. It's really fun and it's really cool. It's interesting, which we have a clip that we talked about with Jerry earlier, but the whole weed story did not exist. And we had a script done and that was the plan. HBO had officially approved that script. And
hey, Doug, has that ever happened where weed just... There's a drought and you can't get weed? Is that really?
Well, it's not real anymore because now it's legal and it's everywhere.
But back in the day, that was based on a real thing.
And I'm not sure if Weiss or Larry said that this was happening at the time, but it was happening at the time that we did it. So it felt very real to people. Yeah, I mean, again, like everything on the show, we didn't do anything that we thought was like just highly unrealistic. We based things on things that were happening. So obviously, if you had enough money, you could find it. But at this particular moment, they couldn't find anything. This episode, though, has some great stuff going on in it besides that, which is, you know, this E-Ari stuff, which I love and really builds in that real food daily area. But this is where we introduce, first of all, a couple of things. First, nudity in the show, as far as I know. And it is not a woman.
That was too much.
Yeah, it was Josh Labar.
Yeah.
And his ass.
It was nice
right
to have his
face.
Ass right in my face.
I had to hold my hand up to the
But
screen.
I will say, like, the Josh Weinstein character, Josh Labar, I thought he murdered it.
I did too, I was
hysterically laughing, even with his ass in my face.
Lee, what up, dog?
Not much. How about you?
Never better.
Who's that jerk off?
No clue.
Yanks are playing the Angels Tuesday. Got the company box if you want to roll with. Got the gals from the L Word coming. Trust me, they're only acting.
trying to be an asshole or anything, but we know each other.
Are you kidding me? Josh Weinstein, Triad. Met at the fight.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right. Josh, do me a favor. Put a towel on or something. I'll cover up.
Not a locker room guy. No problem.
Not a locker room guy, huh?
And he's based on a real guy.
By the way, I'm not a locker room guy. I could do without that. Like, there's an appropriate amount of time to be naked in the gym. And outside of that, it gets disrespectful.
I watched last night and watching that because Ian Ari kind of had a lot of things from my life. And watching you last night, that's me. Like, locker rooms is not my thing. Naked guys talking to me. Like, way before coronavirus, I didn't walk around a locker room without shoes. And people who walk around the locker room and just want to talk to you they're clothed.
That's the three of us. No good. I'm not a locker room guy.
No good. But,
throw a towel on that thing.
But Josh Weinstein was based on a real guy, Josh Klein, who that's a great story with Mark because I think he wanted to sign Mark. He was like a young assistant.
He was like a young guy at UTA. He was like a junior agent at UTA. And Mark said, if you last a round in the ring, I'll fire Ari and I'll sign with you. And Wahlberg dropped him with a body shot like 8 seconds into the first round.
I think he broke like two of his ribs, but he got, you know, Mark got a whole crew. And by the way, when the show started, we looked for a Mark Wahlberg type. Very hard to find. That's why he's a movie star, because they just don't exist. Adrian was the perfect guy once we got him, but it was not what we were looking for. We were looking for a Mark guy. So I obsess about everything. That story was one of the most important stories to me to be in this show. And then we got Adrian. I'm like, I don't know if Adrian's breaking anybody's rib with a shot, but...
No.
Yeah, he ain't winning a boxing. You could survive a round. Yeah, you could survive a round. Side note, Doug, that was the first time we dropped the Islander logo.
Bringing in Islander stuff, which was just really Connolly and I and Dylan, who's like this
Rangers, baby.
Obsessive Ranger fan. So
that's just weird. Yeah, I'm cutting that from the podcast.
You guys are the only two Islander fans I know. I mean, who's an Islander?
Well, we're from the island. But
well, yeah. I understand you, Doug, because they had that great run. What was it? That dynasty?
80, yeah, 80, I was there too, bro.
You were in diapers.
I had already been audited by the IRS in that time, bro. I was good to go. I was an adult.
You know, just since we're talking about it, you know, there's different fans. Queens are typically Mets fans, not Yankees fans, but I'm a Yankees fan, so the guys became Yankees fans. And the reason the guys became Queens fan, which was from Queens, was one of my obsessive things, and whether I'm right or wrong, I mean, we had a lot of tough guys on Long Island, as Kevin knows, but there was something about Long Island. I didn't want that image of it being Long Island guys, because a lot of people, when they think of Long Island, think jappy guys and rich guys, so...
Steroid meatheads.
Yeah, well, not even so much that. I think it's more those jappy, rich Long Island Jewish guys, you know?
I think too, Doug, I just have to say this, because aside from this podcast, it's something that drives me crazy, like, well, how are you? Like, what does that mean? I'm whatever I want to be. My parents are from the Bronx.
Yeah, you talk about fans?
My mom and dad grew up both near Yankee Stadium. They moved to Long Island. They were Yankee fans. We were Yankee fans. It don't matter where you live.
I mean, you inherit your teams.
You're angry about it, but the fact of the matter is most people from Queens.
You can think whatever you want. You're a big boy.
By the way, you'll be getting lots of messages about this because I used to get a lot of shit about it. Why aren't they Mets fans? But anyway, we went with that. But more importantly,
clearly was. I made that clear that Johnny Drama, and I made sure Vince was also a Met fan.
But more importantly than that, what I was talking about is I wanted the guys. We spent a lot of time on where they were from, and we ultimately settled on Queens. Brooklyn almost was too tough.
I think it's perfect.
Yeah.
It's got a little of the Long Island.
Yeah.
The accents all worked out.
And really what they are, though, at the end of the day, which is why they can be fans of anything, like Kevin says, they're New Yorkers. And I think anyone who's from New York and grew up in middle-class areas or lower middle-class areas knows these kind of guys. Yeah. And that's pretty much how the three of us grew up.
And, of course, Dom was from the Bronx.
Yeah.
Not too far from where I'm from.
Dom, who will get on this show.
Yes. He's the best.
Is really the best. So.
Love that guy.
Yeah, and he took a lot of shit for that character.
Yeah, he did. You know that? He caught some heat.
I mean, we went with his real name. And, you know, Dom was actually the initial turtle. You know, that's who I saw as turtle before I ever met Jerry.
Wow.
That was the tougher Wahlberg.
They didn't like him punching Turtle. Yeah, he's like, I'm driving. He punched and they stole my Le Creusettes.
They didn't like him taking your pots. They didn't like him trying to cook for
taking
you.
Taking my
Le
Creusettes.
My La Creusette, bro.
I remember we were trying to figure out how to even say that line.
Weiss knew all the products. Like, if we needed something, you know, like, Drama really became a guy who was an aficionado of like lotions and products and stuff.
Yeah.
But I would always I was thinking about that, I'm like, Weiss, what's a good facial ointment? He'd be like, Peter Thomas Roth. You got to go with that. Like, he always knew it.
Peter Thomas Roth. Roth wrinkle face
anti-aging
cream.
Stuff.
Anti-aging wrinkle face cream.
Yeah, I can't wait to have Weiss on here because he knows every freaking product. Yeah. Do you do a skin regimen? Is that something you guys
do? I don't
do
anything.
Yeah, I don't
even. I don't even put on moisturizer.
Connolly definitely really does. Connolly looks
do
like
every
a moisturizer.
Night, yeah. I take care of my face, yeah.
That's why you look so good, Kevin. Back to five. Such a good episode.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I look at it now just from like a pure fan standpoint. I don't even remember how some things came about, but Bo was fantastic.
I love the scene at the gym.
Yeah.
Do you remember the scene
great.
At the gym?
I think that's where we introduced that you're the trainer. I don't think that comes up before that. It might.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no, it didn't come up before that. I go, oh, yeah, she thinks she's his trainer. And I think he goes,
so do you.
You think you're his trainer? I'm like, what, I'm not? The fuck did I get my trainer?
Certification. The fact that you're like a certified trainer.
Certified trainer. It's hilarious. Just so I could train Vince.
Yeah. Everyone asks, where did these characters come from? The initial inspiration, as I've always said, is Mark Wahlberg. Then they sort of morphed into lots of guys. But Johnny Drama, who there is a real Johnny Drama.
Yeah.
You can see him on Wahlburgers.
Johnny Alves. Great
hilarious guy.
Great guy.
Was a trainer, and all of his stretching and his kind of thing was a lot of the character, and then there were a few other characters from my
Do you remember
friends.
The Hollywood Squares, bro? That was in the script at one stage. You're like, because that's what he used to do. The guy's got the sickest
stabs.
I do remember that. Johnny Alves.
Yeah.
And it was in the script. Check out the Hollywood Squares, bro.
Yeah.
And I was like, Doug, I don't have Hollywood Squares like that, man. My abs are...
You had the big calves. You wanted to show off the big calves,
I'm
not
good
the
on
abs.
The calves. But, and then I'm not supposed to have calves.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that a lot because Dylan was so upset about, like, why am I getting calf implants? I have giant, enormous calves.
I like the storyline, but...
Yeah. You thought it should go to someone else.
I was very proud of my calves.
You have good calves.
Yeah. We will not be shooting an insert on my calves because it'll be off story, Dylan said. Right? Have to get
the director tried to do it. He's like, all right, now whip out those calves. Like, you don't want to see them, bro.
You don't want to see these cannons.
No.
Whip out the... Ew.
Whip out gross. Those calves. Gross,
so this episode also really shows you that Vince is kind of... He's kind of in control and kind of enjoys all of the manipulation of you guys by acting like this girl is really in control when he knows she's leaving at the end of the episode, but he throws everybody off.
So was he just acting the whole time, or was he really falling for a little bit and going?
I think he was.
It seemed like he was player on that.
I always looked at Vince kind of like Warren Beatty in Shampoo, if you know the movie. I think he loves all these girls. I don't think but he doesn't get attached. And if they're leaving, he's not the kind of guy who's going to stop someone from leaving, you know? And as he said in an earlier episode, he never breaks up with anybody. It just kind of fades out, whatever it does. So I think he's...
That's what I do too. I just behave badly and then they'll break up with me.
Has that happened? Is that how two marriages went
down? Oh, yeah, that's how I got rid of
one
all.
Marriage. One marriage, right?
Yeah, just one for me, Doug.
Genius. I don't know how I got two. And Connolly has gone zero.
Your second one doesn't really 40, count, does it?
It was like 70 days. Does that count? Yeah. I don't count it. I forgot it happened. But Connolly is now 41, 42.
Are you high?
It's
I'm
40.
46 years old. I'm 46.
I don't understand. I still think of everybody as like kids. I don't get it. But Connolly
Jerry's 40. Sorry, Jerry's 40.
I can't believe Jerry's 40. Jerry
That's
was
crazy.
Really a kid when we started this thing. I mean, it's nuts.
So I'm 14 years older. So we were playing kind of
So you're really stupid that you were in high school with him. I mean, that's a dumb guy. He's done 14 years.
Took a little while to get out of high school.
Connolly, though, I'm proud of you. You went 46 years without a divorce. God bless you. So that's something to be proud of.
Yeah, I mean, that's the desired effect, that's right? I mean, I want to have kids.
Well,
you
can't commit. You got commitment issues.
Yeah. So you want to have kids? When do you think you'll do that? I
mean, Maybe this year.
Yeah, if you got any
swimmers. We got news coming here, but we got nothing official to say.
Well, I hope you got a girlfriend now.
Well, yes, I'm in a very serious relationship, Dylan.
Nice.
It's getting real nervous, but it's a great girl.
Oh yeah, I'm shaking in my boots. I'm nervous. I'm not nervous at all.
All right, so Queens Boulevard becomes a big part of this thing. So what I wanted to discuss with you guys.
Is this first time we hear the words Queens Boulevard?
Yeah. Josh Weinstein brings this movie that Giant Ari doesn't know, which really, again, if you know Hollywood, Vince is on his way up. So the idea of doing an independent movie with a shitty director that nobody knows who will ultimately become Billy Walsh. Ari's right. This is a bad idea, even if this is a great script. So you guys, in your careers, can you just fill the audience in on the difference between Kevin Dillon, you've done huge movies, The Doors, Platoon, etc., Poseidon. Kevin Connolly, you've done enormous movies, The Notebook, and what's the the romantic comedy that everybody
just
loves.
Just not that into you.
Yeah. So, so what I want to
got a few under my belt.
But I want to talk about the small independent movies that you've done and the difference between that.
Well, I'd say the best experience about being on a big big show is you got great food, great trailer. The worst parts would be, you know, the days are kind of long. You can be bored out of your mind on a big movie. You'll do maybe just 2 pages a day, mm-hmm. 2-3 pages. We were shooting 8 pages a day on Entourage. That made it fly.
We honestly shot Entourage like an independent film because we weren't that high a budget, and I wanted lots of locations, and we shot all over. And every time you move,
we weren't a high budget though. I thought we
got higher and higher.
Not that first year.
We were as low as HBO had, and we shot the pilot in 4.5 days till the reshoot. I mean, that's crazy with at least 10 to 12 locations.
You know, to Dylan's point, the big movies are you make more money.
Yeah.
It can be boring because you're doing longer hours and covering less ground.
Yeah,
right?
You're sitting around a lot more.
It's funny. I remember my first day on He's Just Not That Into You. It was like between, you know, seasons of Entourage. And I got that first call sheet. I started laughing. I was like, this is it? We should be done by 10:30. You know what I mean? It was like
it's
literally
crazy.
A page and 3/8. Yeah. We were doing 7.5, 8, 9, 10 pages.
I know.
Do you got anything? Like you've been on a set and you're like, I can't believe this is a professional movie?
Right.
Like,
but also too, the thing about the independent is like, that's where you do your labor of love. Right. And that's
sometimes,
but that's kind of what this episode is about. I mean, it's like Queens Boulevard, love the script. It's about our hometown. Figuratively speaking, I guess. Yeah, you know, the trailers, if
the
any.
Honey wagon.
Terrible food. Yeah. No money. Then you hope it's Swingers.
Yeah.
Really? That's really the best thing you could do.
Not Fat Beach, you're saying.
Yeah, no, I would have preferred to have been part of Swingers. Yeah. Not Fat
Me
Beach.
Too. Me too,
but usually
by the
worst part about low-budget movies is the acting, really. You're not usually working with, you know, great actors in a lot of cases.
And a lot of times it's like, hey, was that in focus?
Yes.
Okay, well, we got it. We got to move, you know? That's really the bummer when you don't know that you had it, you know?
Well, so on this episode, these guys, which often happens with a movie star when they start to get a little ground, they want a movie that they love. And this is a movie that they love. And it's the first time, I don't know how many other things we've seen on TV where you get to see the behind the scenes process of Vince, this allegedly big movie star, wants this movie, but the producer can't stand him. And I think Stanley DeSantis, who, rest in peace, he passed away.
He was great.
He was the producer, Scott.
He was so good.
And these guys had to sit down and convince him to do that. Yeah. But also in this episode, we see the stuff, which I love. You know, the show's about these four fish out of water guys, street guys from New York that come to this fantasy land, and vegan food now is in favor. But in 2003, when you guys were shooting in the Real Food Daily, that wasn't really that big. And just the expressions of everybody about the vegan and the meat is murder. And one of my favorite lines when Ari says, you know, even broccoli screams when you rip it out of the ground.
Yeah.
So had you had experiences with that? Are you any kind of health guy? You a meat guy? What are you?
I'm a meat guy. I'm a total meat guy. But I just had my girlfriend staying in our guest house for a little while.
Yeah.
And she's a vegan. It's tough. It's tough trying to figure out.
And also, too, you don't want to be judged. It's like, look, if you're a vegan, you're a vegan. But don't look at me funny because I'm eating a steak or
piece
of chicken. Yeah, she's cool like that. But
I dated someone who just didn't eat anything. So that's not fun. You know, I mean, literally, like, no, anywhere you go, it's like there's nothing for her to eat there. So, you know, when the show started, I don't even think, you know, I had no idea where it was going. So there was no thought or process that there's going to be these running storylines. Yeah. A lot of shows, especially back then, were one-offs and it could be a day in the life. But for whatever reason, I started writing like that and that's where we went. So Queens Boulevard became a major focus and a major focus for E! To go get this movie for Vince. Anyone ever been like a big advocate? Did you ever have a problem like that? Like the story here was Ari's like, I want to get this guy paid and I want to make him a movie star. I don't want to put him in some fucking little movie. So have your agents ever like...
No, it's like my brother Matt did this after something about Mary. He, you know, it was a huge hit.
Yeah.
And then he decided to do his little pet project and write, direct, produce, and act in this movie that he shot in Cambodia. And it's a great film called City of Ghosts.
Yeah. By the way, good for him.
But it was just bad timing.
Yeah,
I'd be good for him.
Good for him.
Yeah, I think he did what he wanted to do.
I got no problem with that. He's calling his own. She did it his way, bro.
Yes, he did.
Listen, we love Matt, and it's not the point to knock him.
But he was on fire at that moment.
Yeah,
so,
but
you know,
we see what we know what happens in a career. And even like Colin Farrell's an incredible actor who's done amazing movies. But when we wrote that pilot, Colin Farrell was going to be Leo. Colin Farrell was going to be everybody. And things happen. He's not a worse actor or a better actor. And I always say this, about Kevin Dillon or Kevin Connolly. It's like, you could have been Matt LeBlanc's part on Friends in a heartbeat, and then you could have had this 15-year career.
That would have been nice.
Yeah, and made a $1 billion. Made $1 billion.
But then again, I wouldn't have been Johnny Drama had I done that, I bet. I mean, you couldn't play both of those guys, right?
Probably. No. Well,
so I don't know if
I like how you're thinking both. It would be a good resume, though.
Yeah.
Playing Joey and Johnny Drama. But I'm just saying, it's like an actor. You guys are both great actors, and it's about getting the right part at the right time with the right breaks, because this show could have gone sideways a million different ways, and it could have not ever been picked up, and nobody would know that. So I think it's just wild to watch that process.
The funny thing about the Queens Boulevard run is that it really does stand the test of time. I get that a lot, I feel like.
Get what?
I am Queens Boulevard.
Yeah.
I am.
Like Queens Boulevard references.
Yeah.
I think it was a bit of an anthem for people from Queens, and people liked it. You know what I mean? And it was a good, and then, you know, that also rolled into the next season.
Yeah.
He doesn't say I am Queens Boulevard till season two.
Right.
And it's to be honest with you, I thought maybe there was a chance that we would shoot in New York, you know, Queens Boulevard. And we did end up shooting in New York.
For a day.
Yeah.
2 days, maybe.
I was hoping we'd get a little bit more of New York.
I always wanted to do, I don't know if you remember me pitching this, Doug, but I always like wanted to do, like, between seasons, like, wouldn't it be great? Let's do like short film versions of the movies.
Yep.
Like, give me a camera, black and white camera. Let me go out and shoot a couple scenes from Queens Boulevard.
We talked about doing that with Viking Quest,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly. Like, let's do a Viking Quest episode.
On and make it real cheesy.
Well, now you see the difference. Now there's so much need for content and so many different areas. We would be doing all of that stuff if it was today. It would be on everyone's Instagram. It would be on HBO's site. It would be everywhere. So it's a different world, and the amount of content that goes around a TV show and things that you can explode, including these podcasts. I mean, every show now has a podcast too. So it's pretty wild to see the differences of what has happened. Back to that drive and Queens Boulevard with E, and then you've got Drama there. And I'm trying to remember, like, were you involved in the Vince story, and were you involved with Matt at all? Did you ever have discussions with your brother, like, maybe you should go do this? Or?
Yeah, we were close to doing a couple of movies. There was a movie called Boxer and the Blonde, and it was about the fighter.
I was one of my very favorite scripts.
Oh, you remember that? Yeah,
Ron Shelton was attached to that.
Yeah.
That's the guy that did Bull Durham. I mean, that was a real movie.
It was about Billy Kahn, the great boxer who ended up almost knocking out.
Oh, you guys were going to do that together?
Joe Louis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I would have been the brother who's, you know, he had his brother in his ring.
Right. So I know. I think, Doug, were you asking him, like, do you ever give him, like, I don't know, Matt, maybe it's something about Mary, maybe you should do something.
I love this answer.
We got to work together. We at some stage, we're going to work together. It's crazy that we haven't yet.
And all of your friends, like, you got a good, talented group of dudes. You guys need to go out and make a movie. You and D.B. Sweeney and, like, Matt.
Yeah, no doubt.
All the boys. You guys got some real heavy hitter actors in there, man. I always wait for that.
Because I know Connolly has some big movie star friends who really did. They loved the show. I mean, they I remember they used to not want to, they used to want to watch it live Sunday nights. They didn't want to hear what was going to happen. And, you know,
I mean, some of the people that you knew were watching the show were just almost like hard to wrap. It was almost hard to wrap your head around. You know?
Yeah.
The crazy thing is my daughter, Amy, was going to high school when the show was on.
That's what you want. That's what you want your kid to be, by the way.
She would go back to school after Sunday, a Monday morning, and they'd all be like, "Your dad last night.
Your dad was spanking
with Ken the masseuse. He was spanking in the all these crazy storylines." So she's like, "Dad, it's so embarrassing."
Was she? Did she get embarrassed?
She was kind of embarrassed by it, but then she learned to, you know, enjoy it, and she liked the show as well.
Drama and you together, whatever that was. There was a magic that you could bring really over-the-top shit and make it feel real and be so devoid of thinking that there's anything, whatever word you want to use. There's nothing gay about it.
What the fuck are you doing, bro?
Like, you really are stunned by it. I wanted this story on the show. I was kind of obsessed with it and never figured out which character or what it was. But your Vegas story, which I think is one of the great stories ever.
You know, I was underage gambling in Vegas.
Before Entourage.
Before Entourage. Oh, yeah. No, this is 94. I didn't have anything, really. I had no money at all.
I
was with Henry Penzi. Well, no, that's what I'm saying.
You're with Henry Penzi.
Henry Penzi's the one that set up the trip. It was a charity.
I never heard that.
Basketball game. So that's the reason why we were even allowed in the hotel. And I had a friend, a girl that was a friend that was a girl. And that is a big difference because we were friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her to run some money through a slot machine for me. And the sickest part about this is that I went to the cage and broke a $10 bill with quarters. And on 50 cents, we hit $403,348.
She kept the money. Royal Flush, right?
No, it was a Quarter Mania. It was like boom, 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 boom. It was a progressive slot, and she kept the money and told me to go fuck myself. There was nothing to do.
She's still around.
Well, she blocked me on a bunch of, because like every year on the anniversary, I would tweet at her.
You owe me.
She didn't expect it to come back like that.
She literally blocked me on Instagram. She, I can't even get a hold of her.
Wow.
But you've seen her in the years since, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, the ironic thing is, and whatever, I don't want to sound like we're bragging here, but she used to work for a company that was the seat fillers.
Right.
So, well, we would be at an awards show or something.
We would be running to the Giants.
I would be like, yeah, we're going to take a piss and get a quick drink. Get somebody. She would get people to fill the seats.
Well, you know what? That's not breaking, because there is karma to that. And there is something in the universe that worked out. And, and I mean, it is a mind-boggling story, no matter how many times I hear it, that someone would do that. But
hey, talk about seat fillers. Do you remember when we were at the Emmys? Every year, the Giants were in the playoffs. We would run down to the ESPN zone and watch the games.
Yeah, we would sneak out of Staples.
Like, you gotta go.
They're like, you just gotta be in your seats for best TV comedy. We'd be like, yeah, okay, we'll be at the ESPN zone.
I think I was nominated on one of those years, so we're running back.
I love talking about the Emmys. I mean, because you know, you get the whole thing that like it's you're happy just to be there, blah, blah, blah. Which listen, when you get that Emmy nomination, it's one of the great feelings of your life. And you were nominated for an Emmy, correct?
A couple, yeah.
You were nominated for Golden Globe for sure. Okay, no Emmy. But same thing.
When that call comes in the morning, there's few things like it.
It is amazing. But when you lose, there's few things like
the
it also.
I was just nominated for Golden Globe, but nobody remembers it. Because it was the year they canceled.
It was the lockout season.
Well,
also too for people listening to the show, and I guess this is kind of common knowledge, but the big difference between the Emmys and the Golden Globes is that the Golden Globes is really a party.
Yeah.
You're sitting at a table, you get drinks, you got food. This is like one of my favorite like Kevin Dillon stories, and this is why I always love the Golden Globes.
I'm scared.
I mean,
right
like,
now.
Look, we're gonna get there. Yeah, I don't think it's any secret that Kevin and Adrian. It's funny because Jerry would come with us, but before a red carpet or something, we would meet up and have a drink, you know, and walk the carpet together. We always had a great time doing
that. Well, me and you would usually throw each other under the bus.
We had to call a ceasefire.
Ceasefire. I won't say anything about you.
Dillon said that I looked like Connolly walked into work this morning looking like he got maced on CNN.
Because you would look hungover.
I said, Kevin. And
the reason
you knew,
I did that, Kevin.
I'm like, Kevin, this is a fucking war.
You hit me on the fake tan. Because I was at one of those giveaway suites, you know, and he's like, look at Dillon got a fake tan because I got a spray tan on. So I was like, oh, okay. You want to go like that?
And
then I went with him being maced.
On CNN, by the way. So Kevin and I, you know, we're out at the bar. And we're at the bar at the Golden Globes. And we got a nice little buzz. We come back. We're having a fucking great time. Dillon and I are sitting next to each other. And it's Million Dollar Baby and Hilary Swank wins Best Actress for $1 Million Baby.
And forgets to thank our boy Chad Lowe.
And she's given the speech. And she's like, you know, Clint, you know, I think, you know, this is some of the best work you've ever done. And Dylan's like,
what
was the movie?
I said, clearly she hasn't seen Outlaw Josie Wales.
Oh, yeah, that's it. That's what it was. Oh, clearly she hasn't seen Outlaw Josie Wales. I had to walk out. I was laughing so hard. I was like, okay, this isn't funny to anybody else. But Dillon and I was fucking out the door. But it was awesome.
Hey, Kev, you got to help me out right here. The guy who won, he went to my school.
Oh, my goodness. Bennett Miller is the guy's name. And he directed Capote. He directed Foxcatcher. He directed Moneyball. This guy's the real deal. Now, the other good thing, too, about the Golden Globes, which is always my favorite part about the Golden Globes, is like, first of all, you have a reason to be there. Your show is nominated. So you don't feel like a loser being there. But we're... You know, you get to hang out. You're hanging out with cool people. We're out on the back again, cigarette smoking days. Dillon and I having
Kevin
a cigarette.
Bacon,
it's me, Dillon, Kevin Bacon, and we're just like shooting the shit and smoking.
And
this guy, Bennett Miller, walks up to Kevin and you know, we were in the middle of a story. He did kind of, whatever. I'm not making excuses for us. He did kind of roll up on us Dillon was in mid story. And he says to Kevin, yeah, you know, we went to high school together. Dylan's like, really? Hope I didn't smack you around too bad. Right? And then he
goes, as a matter of fact.
No. He said, you know, actually, you were very nice to me. And Dylan's like, well, what are you doing here? And he's like, no, I directed a movie that's, you know, I'm not
good. I'm
nominated.
Glad he said that because I was nice to him. Yeah, I liked him. Yeah, I always liked Ben.
Yeah, well, this is the funny part. You're like, what are you doing here? He's like, you know, I directed a movie. I'm nominated for Best Director. And like, what movie? He's like, Capote. He's like, you directed Capote? Bennett Miller goes, yeah. And he's like, you know, I always liked you, right, bro?
That is probably true.
Yo, and I did
always like him. Right. I mean, he did this show.
He said you were nice to him.
My high school would do this television show,
right?
LMCTV, and he would do this thing called Ben the Barbarian, and he was hilarious.
Yeah, he said.
But
that.
When he did,
that's why
come
he came up.
Me,
he felt comfortable. He felt.
I'm just glad I didn't steal his lunch money because that would have been bad.
I had this like look of shock on my face. I was just kind of sitting, and I remember Kevin Bacon saying. Oh yeah, no, you heard that. That happened. That just happened. I'm like, okay, good. I'm glad you could get that.
That's what's amazing about the Golden Globes. You're kind of surrounded in the mix with everybody.
Remember this one?
I remember that.
I know what you're gonna say.
So Dylan and I would do that. We had a history like
we would try and humiliate each other every chance we could.
At times we had to back off it. We knew it was getting a little hot
but
and heavy.
We were still in it.
Right. It was getting hot and heavy. It would be like, all right, let's cool this.
I was at the urinal at the Golden Globes.
Right, Dylan.
And you came up next.
But Dylan like went in front of me. We went together, and he got. I got. Dylan is in the urinal, and there are crazy. There are crazy people in the bathroom.
Like everyone.
It's like Pierce Brosnan, Malkovich. I mean, the list goes on and on of people that are in the bathroom. And I walk in and Dylan looks over his shoulders like, cover up, gentlemen. We got a peeker here. When I tell you, there were guys that you would think don't even have a personality
they
or a sense of humor.
Busted out.
Fucking not a person in that room
busted
was it.
Out.
The entire room was.
And by the way, they were covering
laughing.
Up a little bit too. They're like, whoa, watch out for this peeker.
You know what?
That's too funny.
It really is great because I did a pilot. Right after our show with
Kissing a Fool?
I did a pilot with Michael Imperioli and Eddie Burns and Michael Rappaport. And we had this camaraderie, but we never could find the fourth guy to get that, which is why it ultimately didn't work. And the fact is, you guys had that camaraderie pretty instantaneously,
yeah,
and it's kind of lasted.
Did.
And kind of like your best friends from high school, when we get together, it's the same shit. It's like nothing.
We got lucky.
Nothing
has
changed.
You did a great job with the casting.
Dylan and I have been drinking buddies for a long time.
As soon as we met.
Yeah.
As soon as we met.
But not before the show.
No, but I mean, like, we met. I mean, that was the other thing, too. We really are, in some way, shape, or form, we did have a lot in common, all of us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes,
so
we did.
It came pretty easy.
You know, we grew up basically in the same place. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. That was funny. Those were some good times. And we always, you know, the other thing too that I always loved about the group is that, you know, Piven is Piven and he's going to be Piven. And that was always fine. We liked walking the carpet. Piven never wanted to walk the carpet with us. But we liked walking the carpet together.
We'd like, have fun together. We'd bounce off each other.
It took a little something off it. It wasn't as much pressure. We did our thing.
Well, guys, by the way, we walked a lot of carpets because
we
are the Buffalo Bills. 0-6 for best comedy on the Golden Globes.
Man.
0-5 best comedy in the Emmys. And some other losses for
our individuals.
Stuff
but we
so
did win
we got,
a BAFTA.
We won a BAFTA.
Jeremy brought a bunch home.
Dude, Jeremy, listen, man, whatever. Say what you want about Jeremy. 3 Emmys in a row.
A lot of those are at my expense, but.
Well, Dylan, I say this, and I can say it because I'm already on the record saying it. I think one of those was yours. And Piven played the game.
Well,
you were not a Hollywood guy.
I thought you were saying they misread the envelope. Like
no,
a Marissa
I
Tomei
think
thing.
That one of those had Dylan's name on it if he played the game, which no knock to
I
Jeremy.
I don't play the game. I really don't.
You don't. But if you played the game, one of those was yours for sure. Do you remember the one year, Kev, we really, really... I mean, we were literally like pressing our, but we thought this is it. It just felt like the fucking guy was going to say
season 4 or something like that. Season 5.
Tragic.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Tragic.
What are you going to do?
I really am glad that I don't have to go to those award shows anymore. 4 year. That was a grind. I mean,
I thought you sound like you had a great time.
We did.
We did, but I mean, putting on a tuxedo and just, you know, missing playoff games.
It's funny because I really, more in hindsight, I realized how bad my anxiety was. I just always had a hard time on the carpets. I wish I would have enjoyed that a little more, to be honest. All right, when we come back from the break, we're going to have the writer, the script, and the Sherpa. Comedy legend, Larry Charles. Sometimes picking wine can be hard. You're not sure which wine to pick. There's so many. You're at a crowded supermarket, cruising the wine aisle, feeling lost, intimidated, or just tired of always buying the same thing. You want to explore, but you don't know where to begin. That's why you need First Leaf. Here's why. As America's most personalized wine company, First Leaf takes the guesswork out of wine selection. It's easy. You take their short taste quiz and rate the first few wines they send you. Then, First Leaf will use your response to curate customized selection of delicious, award-winning wines based on your personal preferences with a 96% accuracy. A variety of new and exciting wines will be delivered to your door, with each bottle priced lower than what you would pay at a wine store. You even get to choose when you receive your wine, and every selection is backed by First Leaf's satisfaction guaranteed. When I'm driving home to pick up a bottle of wine for dinner, I stare at the wall. There's so many selections. There's wine everywhere. I don't know which way is left or which way is right. So that's why if you sign up today and get your first six bottles for $39.95 plus free shipping, go to tryfirstleaf.com/victory. That's tryfirstleaf.com/victory to get your first six bottles for $39.95 plus free shipping. Tryfirstleaf.com/victory.
I am excited tonight. We have a comedy legend and honestly a guy who really helped save my life. Larry Charles is really a comedy legend who's worked on some of the greatest shows ever, Seinfeld, Mad About You, and he's made some of the most successful comedy movies ever, three of them with Sacha Baron Cohen that he directed. And he's also worked with Bob Dylan and directed Masked and Anonymous and with Bill Maher doing an amazing movie that if you haven't seen, Religulous, you should see immediately because it's fantastic. But
and on a little show called Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Can I leave Curb? Only my favorite show, by the way. But you know, and by the way, how Entourage all started, I don't even know if Larry knows this, but I wrote a Curb Your Enthusiasm spec and sent it to Lev, who was my manager, and he was like, wow, I guess you can write. So anyway, that's how the whole show started. So Larry, most importantly, though, forgetting all your amazing credits, my life, the reason you're most important is because you really were a lifesaver to me. When the show started, I was asked to hire some television writers. I didn't know anybody. I hired Rob Weiss, who was my friend from high school, who is great, but like me, had no idea what he was doing. And we basically used to scream at each other till 4 o'clock in the morning every night trying to figure out the show. And HBO said, Larry Charles is interested in A, dealing with you guys, and B, helping you elevate this show to a level that might actually make people watch it. So we got Larry in, and you know, I want to talk about all of your stuff in your career, but let's start with some of the Entourage stuff. And if you remember when you first got that pilot, what made you think you wanted to get involved with this?
Well, exactly. It was the pilot. I thought you captured immediately in the pilot this very, very unique subculture of people from New York who transplanted out here, trying to find their way, buddies, but with that kind of cutting edge humor that you only see in New York. As soon as you get out of New York, people just think you're insane, you know, when you talk that way. But the truth is, that is how you show love in New York City, you know, whether it's Long Island, whether it's Brooklyn, whether it's Queens or Bronx or Staten Island.
Tough love.
That is a communication form that connects people, strangely enough. And I connected to that. I really did. I grew up that way with, you know, friends that I was so tight with, but you talk to each other as if, you know, an outside person would completely misinterpret. And I thought that, wow, that's a unique voice that I hadn't seen in any kind of TV show. And I thought you really captured it, you know, and you captured the LA, the alienation and the desires of LA also. I think it was one of the first things I was ever called, like, aspirational, actually.
Yeah.
You know? And I thought this is great. And they said, you know, we want to redo a couple of scenes, and you know. But I thought this show has... And look, Carolyn and all those people were very cool and fantastic, but I'm not sure they really got what this was.
No, they definitely didn't. Chris did. Chris definitely got it. Everyone else is like, yeah, all right, we'll give it a shot. It doesn't cost that much money, and we'll kill Larry and make him work on two shows at the same time.
Right.
But, for those of you at home,
it was worth it, though. I felt it was worth it because I connected so much to the material, to the whole milieu of that world, that I felt like I could help make this great.
And by the way, all of that plays into the show because we're sitting here when the show is in my head, and obviously Mark Wahlberg let me switch it from Boston to New York and really kind of bring in my experiences. But we have a room here with Kevin Connolly, who grew up 15 minutes from me. Kevin Dillon grew up 30 minutes from me. And you were born in Brooklyn and raised in Brooklyn, correct? And
yes.
I was born in Brooklyn and then raised on Long Island. But we really are, and Jerry as well, and Adrian are real New Yorkers through and through. And I think all of that comes out in the show. And Kev, what were you saying?
Well, I was going to say, for people listening, Chris Albrecht, who is the head of HBO, greenlit Sex and the City,
Sopranos,
Sopranos, Entourage. Was he obviously curbed? I mean, yeah. Like Chris Lilberg.
He was actually Larry David's agent originally. Oh, he was the bartender at the Improv.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
And by the way,
I know all those seminal comedians.
And when this show started, when Andre started, Chris Albrecht was like the gangster. We were all, not you, Larry, we were all scared to death to even talk to the guy, to say anything.
But he
wrong.
Was totally cool.
He was the best. Yeah. And he's the real, and the reason we got here, and he probably was the reason we got Larry. And Larry ultimately, which we'll get into, was the reason we got Larry David on the show and Val Kilmer.
One of the things that you had, Doug, that I felt Larry David had, and I feel very few other people had, is a very self-assured, confident voice. Very raw at that time and would be refined, but you definitely had a voice, and I also connect to that. When Seinfeld first started, there was this whole thought of like, who's going to relate to these four New Yorkers? You know, and they're Jewish and they're, you know, who's going to, well, everybody related to it.
Yeah.
You know, around the world, everybody relates to it. I have been in the Middle East and met people who go, my friend is just like Kramer.
Right.
You know,
right.
That happens, you know. And the same thing with this show. You created characters and voices and very distinctive voices and yet connected voices that made the show very unique in the flavor of it and the tone of it, because that voice was very special. And most shows are very, very generic. And this show very much wasn't. And maybe that was Chris's insight as well. This had a special flavor that nothing else had. And you see how many pale comparisons, how many pale imitations there have been trying to capture that flavor. But they can't capture that writing and they can't capture that acting. And that's the difference between Entourage and those other shows.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And on that vein, though, I got a question, because I know, one, you're very politically active. Number two, you have strong opinions about this thing. And this really was, when I watched the show back now, because I hadn't watched it in years, there's stuff now that, you know, it does. It makes you blush a little bit and you go, wow. But it was authentic to its time and its place. And my question to you is, it was a different world 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and 40 years ago. So what's your feeling on that?
Well, I've done obviously a lot of thinking about this, and a lot of my work, both with you and elsewhere, definitely falls into that category. And what the conclusion I drew was, ultimately, we tend to think everything's always going to be the same. You know what I mean? So we don't realize that all these pop culture things, whether it's Seinfeld or Entourage or anything really, and you know, the Star Wars, we think of them as these like massive things, and they are within their time frame, but things constantly change. And so I think what's happening right now is there is kind of a change going on in the culture, and it's like an evolution, and in evolution, a lot of bad shit happens, you know?
Right.
It's like maybe on the other side, it'll turn into something good. But in the meantime, there's going to be a churning about what's funny, you know, what's not funny, what's proper, what's politically incorrect. Comedy is like the country, you know, it's completely fragmented. If you like Louis C.K., you can't like Hannah Gatsby. And it's like, it's very hard for these worlds to coexist. That's the battle. Can they figure out a way to synthesize into something better? Or is it just a kind of a symbol of the complete breakdown?
That was an amazing thing when Larry came on the show, because what basically would happen is I would either write something and hand it to Larry or Rob and go, you know what, like, we're going to collaborate. We're going to do whatever, write whatever you want. And ultimately I have to say what I think, but you know, go where you want. And Larry, who is probably a little darker than me, and I am dark, but you would push things to an envelope. And I think what's interesting about that, and I've heard the Zucker brothers, who made some of the best comedies of all time, that you might look at some stuff now and go, whoa, I don't know if I can take that. But I listened to them talk about how they would push each other. And Larry did. Larry would push us to go to the max. And sometimes you go too far, and sometimes you find comedy gold. And that's the fine line that I think works. And Larry was a guy, you got to understand, I watched a man, he would come in, he would write a script on a cocktail napkin in an hour. And I would go, and if I said, I don't know if I liked it, he'd write another one. And you'd go, this is unbelievable. And I remember the day, Larry, episode 3, which I really think, I love the first two episodes looking back now, but episode 3, which I don't even know who's credited on it, but Larry had a major, major hand on that episode.
the first time I saw that cut, I was like, this show is elevated to another level. But the real story behind it, which I don't know if you remember or not, Larry wrote a draft that Rob Weiss and I, who were nervous every time we get a draft, what if we don't like something? How do you tell Larry Charles? Again, doesn't mean it's not great and that it wouldn't have been better. But how do you say, I don't like this? Larry wrote a draft. Rob and I sat in our office and read it. And we both, who are not very emotional guys, we got emotional. Do you remember this draft? It was about Drama's fiance and the whole thing. And do you remember what happened with HBO?
No, no, I don't think so.
HBO almost shut down the show. They said, we don't want this heart. We want fun. We want this and we want that. And what we ultimately came up with in the episode was the heart between the guys. And it still had that same vibe and that amazing ending as Kevin knows the great fucking night.
Oh, yeah.
So I just wondered if you remembered that and how many drafts we kind of went through of everything.
Well, I remember that thinking that, again, we talked about it a minute ago, that HBO really wasn't getting the scope and the breadth of the show. You know, what the show, to me, this had like epic, and really it did that first season. It kind of like builds this like an epic movie onto itself, you know? And I think drawing on the acting talent, drawing on the writing talent and maximizing it, you know, squeezing everything out. Everybody left everything on the table on that show.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I'm always feeling like my best self when I get some exercise. When I'm on a good routine and I'm able to string together a bunch of days of exercise, that's when I'm always feeling at my best. And when you're at your best, you can do great things. But sometimes, it is what it is. Life can get bogged down. You may feel overwhelmed, like you're not showing up the way you want to. Working with a therapist can help you get closer to the best version of you. Because when you feel empowered, you're more prepared to take on everything life throws at you. I mean, it's no secret. I mean, we talk about it all the time on Victory. I've benefited from therapy. I like it. You know, some people think it's not for them. A lot of people are uncomfortable. They think it's too expensive. They don't want to talk to strangers. I mean, I get it. But therapy is good. BetterHelp is good. If you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, flexible, affordable, and entirely online. Fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist at any time for no charge. So if you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Trust me. Visit BetterHelp.com/victory today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/victory.
You know, that is something that I really do appreciate as a work ethic, and it paid off, you know, and I think they didn't realize that, you know, how valuable Jeremy could be. You know, they didn't realize the sort of arc that Kevin's and Adrian and Jerry could have on a show like this, you know?
Do you remember the battles? They didn't want Jeremy on the poster.
Oh, God.
I tell people that all the time.
Well, you know? Jeremy, they're like, he looks too old. He's like, I'm 2 years younger than Dylan.
We're the same age.
You know, listen, so Larry, I was saying too, and I'm curious, Kev, if you agree, like, you know, with regards to Doug, I think Doug, you know, we built up some trust, but I think in that first year, we were all a little nervous and the trust was to come later. But in that first year, when Larry said it was going to be okay, it was going to be okay.
Yeah.
Dylan, did you feel that?
Well, you know, I always thought the show was going to move on. So I believed in this show too. So I knew it had legs and I knew it was going to get picked up for a second season. So yeah, I mean, it was always great to hear if Larry said, this is looking good.
We had Rob Weiss who told me, I was a fucking wreck, not sleeping. I was just didn't know what I was doing and how you come up with an arc for a season or whether it's supposed to be an arc or whether I don't know if this is true or not, but it feels like Seinfeld was one of the first comedies that was a real comedy, but started doing little arcs in it as opposed to just episodes that were self-contained and you could watch any of them. So no one knew what this was going to be, but for whatever reason, I started writing it as a continuation story. And unlike a guy like Larry or David Simon, I really wasn't capable of doing that except for in the crazy, insane process I had. But the difference was Rob Weiss, who was like my brother, he used to say, because I'm like, we got to get someone in here who can just figure this all out. And he would always say, nobody's going to save you, Dougie, every day. Nobody's coming to save you. And Larry would sit there. What do you call those, Larry? Those beads. Larry would rub his beads and just going to be like, we're going to be fine. And it was an amazing calming influence. So what did you see? Did you think we were out of our fucking minds or what?
Well, I think, again, growing up in Brooklyn, your dynamic, which, again, was very intense, but it wasn't something that I wasn't used to. You know what I mean? I basically grew up with people yelling and screaming at each other, you know, and even with Larry David, you know, they're like, we're loud, conflicting people, you know? And so none of that stuff really threw me. And again, I thought if we could synthesize it into something great, which I think we did, and Rob was a crucial part of that also.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I remember pulling you guys apart at times, you know?
Physically.
And, you know, that was sort of my role at times. And then I would go into the room and just, like, try to write something so that we could kind of have a conversation about it. And things worked out. I mean, let's face it, we had really good stuff to start with. There's a great foundation to start with. And then all these things just fell together. Everybody was on, even it's like the 74 Yankees, you know? They might have been fighting, but they were a fucking great team, right. You know?
Right. Kept me going and alive. I saw Larry David, who was really like, we're going to talk about him in a minute, which Larry Charles got him on the show. And of all the stars that's ever been on this show, I've never been intimidated by anyone except for Larry, who now I consider a friend and I love to death. But the day he showed up, we're going to get into that. I was terrified, but I saw.
You were terrified.
Well, we'll get into that also because Dylan had to improvise for the first time. But I saw Larry David talking about when Seinfeld was picked up, and it was similar to Entourage because we only got picked up for 7 additional episodes, which is a very small order, which means they didn't really believe in us. Seinfeld was a similar amount of small numbers. And I saw Larry in an interview go, I didn't know anything. So I spent 2 years trying to figure this script out, 100 drafts, notes from all over the place, this and that. Then they say do 7 more. And I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning going, I don't have a clue what this show is. I don't have any idea what to write or what it is or anything like that. So in the Seinfeld process, in the early days, I'm not comparing us to Seinfeld. Was there any similar mayhem going on behind the scenes there?
Yes, there was. First of all, you know, in my role on Entourage, I was often like a peacemaker, you know, but on Seinfeld, I was more like you.
Right.
And I was extremely volatile and I would sit behind Larry at every script meeting and I would be loyal enough to Larry that I would be screaming at, you know, Warren Littlefield
right.
or the Castle Rock guys. And they must have thought I was fucking insane, you know? But Larry also, we both screamed a lot to get our way. And there was a lot of battles in those early days, you know? And again, like Entourage, there was not a lot of confidence in what it was. But what I learned from Larry that I think I imparted to you, which is something that he learned the hard way and I watched and supported, was trust yourself. Nobody has any answers to this, you know?
Right.
Nobody's right. You have to do it. And if you do it and trust yourself and trust your instincts, it's going to be good. You know, a lot of it's out of your control. People are constantly trying to quantify creativity, but you can't. You know, how your brain works can't be quantified, you know?
Yeah.
So you trusted your instincts about the direction of the show, and that's the show, you know? And if you had listened to all the other voices, again, like Larry also, heavily, heavily influenced to take other routes than the one that we took, but he resisted. He resisted because he felt like he has to trust himself. What else does he have? And if you fail, at least you fail with your own instincts and not somebody else's.
Right. It's really wild to hear that because, by the way, like to think of Larry, who I do, it's weird. I haven't seen you in a long time, and I still feel like I know you extremely well, but I have never seen Larry Charles angry or yelling. And all I remember is Rob and I yelling constantly, nonstop. And you know,
there was some heat. You're getting some heat from the actors too, a little bit too.
Well, you're getting heat from everybody. And listen, at the bottom line is there's a lot of people in Hollywood, as Larry knows, insecurity and fear feeds a lot of things. And when you have a shot, especially at that time, HBO was the biggest game in town. And we had a shot that was, you know, ultimately changed all of our lives. I wanted to capitalize on it, and I really didn't know how. So it was just going on instinct and trying to go. Larry brings in, I mean, this is for any writers out there, and we're going to get into improvisation. This is a really interesting thing. So I wrote the script for the script and the Sherpa, and we have a script, and it's done. And I say, because I was always very self-critical, this thing feels light. It just feels like there's not enough happening. So either Rob or Larry says there's a weed drought in LA. I don't remember what. And I say, okay, but this is a done script.
I read about it.
Okay. So I'm like, how are we gonna fit this into a script? And Larry, I swear to God, in like 9 minutes, basically jotted down every spot that we could add what ultimately became the best part of the episode into this script. And then Larry wrote, I think, on a cocktail napkin, again, this Val Kilmer speech.
It'd be great to have that cocktail napkin.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
It'd be great. Because people love that. And Larry might even still be mad at me this day because I still shortened it. My obsession was to make this show the quickest, fastest thing possible. And I don't even think I realized how much people were going to freak over this Val Kilmer speech, which is still in there for a good amount, but there's an original take that was probably 2 minutes longer. And you wouldn't see that on television ever. It was like a Shakespearean monologue, you know?
It was awesome.
But Larry says, what do you think about Val Kilmer for this part? It was like, one of my idols has worked with Bill, and I'm like, I think he'd be
awesome.
Pretty good.
We could get him.
So tell me about some of the Val. Like, you call him up, and is he like, what is this show, or what happens there?
Well, you know, my history with Val was just very positive. I had asked him to do this Bob Dylan movie, and he came in and did a monologue that we had written for that movie that's like about 7 minutes long.
Right.
And he was great. And again, great to hang out with. He's like a poetic soul. You start to understand him once you spend some time with him, you know. He just has one of those souls that really kind of transcends to a large degree. And I really liked him a lot and admired and respected him. And I look at his work differently now. And I thought, he's a guy that will embrace exactly what we're doing here. He doesn't need even the credit. He doesn't need the work. You know what I mean? He likes the creative experience, you know? And that's why I often promise people that I work with. And that's a way to, you know, because you don't have money quite often, you at least can give them a creative experience that will be memorable. Work with cool people, do some cool stuff. And he was an easy person, actually, to get, as was everybody, by the way.
And
he
Val,
was an easy person to get.
And Val, to this day, a lot of people still don't even know that it was Val.
I posted something on
Instagram last week about Val. They're like, oh, my God, that was Val.
He was the Sherpa?
And I have this amazing photo of because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Sherpa was trying to look a little bit like you. So I have that great picture of the two of you. They have the same beard, and they almost look like brothers, you know?
I think there may be some truth to that. That's right.
So, and then Larry does, you know, the greatest thing ever. He gets Larry David to do the show, okay? Which I am like...
By the way, Larry David is the only person that we ever had on the show that I was on set and didn't approach. I just, I knew I had nothing. I got nothing.
By the way,
No ammo.
Victory the Podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What's up, Victory listeners? Whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too. Enter the name Your Price Tool from Progressive. The name Your Price Tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at Progressive.com to try the name Your Price Tool for yourself and join the over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
By the way, I was in the same boat, and now we're going to get Dylan involved here because Larry goes, Larry David's going to do it. He's excited. I don't know if that was true or not, but he's going to do it, but there's no script. Now, I was like a stickler for every single comma, every single piece of punctuation.
And so is Dylan.
Well, more importantly, Dylan was. And then I got to call Dylan.
I like adding stuff on little bits and pieces.
Now you do. You did not then.
But
no,
I did
but
a little
he,
bit.
He's yeah. saying that he wants a framework. Dylan needs
a framework. I'd like to know where
context.
I'm going. You guys didn't tell me anything.
Well, by the way, I didn't know anything. And I wonder if Larry remembers what happened on the set. Like, we basically gave him an idea that he was screaming at Ari about these tickets. And I remember that it was, in my mind, I had a really simple fix to explain it to Larry. But I wasn't going near Larry David. I was just going like, Larry, you take... And I was sitting back, and I'm telling you, like, there's no one who's been on this show that I was nervous about, but I was nervous about Larry David. So Larry was talking to him, and I'm like, I don't know who I was talking to. I think I have the idea. But you guys were discussing, and Larry, I could see, was getting a little, like, frustrated because no one was telling him what, and I just said, Larry, what if what if you just go over and I'm real nervous when I say this. I said, what if you just go over and like Ari promised you these tickets and they didn't come. And then you turned on the TV and you saw he was sitting next to Vin Diesel. And you're like, oh, I got it. Done. And then he, of course, did it. But Dylan, and you guys can talk a little bit about Larry, how you work with improvisation, which is totally fine with me, by the way. I love improvisation. I always just would say, do one take as written. Do whatever you want, and we'll, whatever's better will work. But I called you up the night before, and you were like, where's the script? I'm like, there's no script, okay? So what was, do you remember how you...
Well, I said, well, what am I doing? And you go, well, don't worry about it. Just come here. And I was like, well, let me just go. So then you sat me in the scene, and you still, so didn't give me anywhere to go. So I didn't know. Everyone else had a kind of a plan.
Yeah.
I had no...
I had no
what
idea.
What does Johnny Drama want? He wants the work. So I just kind of, Larry, you remember... it worked out great. I mean, I loved it. Yeah. I didn't have to study the night before, which was awesome.
We built on it. And
yes.
You know, it's funny, Doug, you're talking about loving every comma. And, you know, I relate to that also at a certain point in my life. And certainly when I think of Larry on Seinfeld, I would never have imagined that he would be interested in improv because he was also a meticulous, very, very specific writer.
Wow.
He expected words to be... He was like you in a lot of ways also. Not really all that experience with actors because you heard the voices in your head so clearly that you needed words to be accented and punctuated. And so did Larry. And I learned a lot from Larry about that aspect of things. But by the same token, by the time we came to Entourage, he didn't feel like memorizing as much. It goes back to trusting your instincts. For him and for this show, what they share in common, the honesty, you know, there is an honesty to Entourage, to the interactions, to the exchanges. When Johnny Drama tries to remind Larry David, you know, if you remember something, we get it. We get that. That's not about show business anymore. You know what I mean? That's about human behavior. And it's a very honest and surprising version of it, you know? And so I think that's the thing it shares with Curb too. The editing becomes a super important part of it also, because you can further structure it in editing if you have enough choices in the shooting, you know? And that's something that Curb really, the first cuts of Curb are like an hour long, you know? And it's about shaping that hour into the show, you know?
That was very different with us because we shot a lot of oneers. And
yes,
fortunately, we had the actors who could deliver it. But when Larry calls you up to do Curb, does he say, we're not going with scripts, we're just going with outlines? Or what does he say?
Well, I feel like I know him well enough and I know what he wants, that the outline and everybody around him, I mean, he has kind of a repertory company at this point.
Right.
So everybody kind of knows what needs to be done, you know? And so the outline is sufficient. You know, people know their roles and they know how to exercise them. And so I think that the structure for that is almost like having a script. It really is. Mm-hmm. Because everybody knows that they just have to be what they would be in that situation and it'll be good.
You know, when you think about some of the great directors we had, and we had some first run directors that went on to become the biggest directors in television. And, you know, as an actor, you always shake your head when it's like, oh man, another angle? Fuck, man.
Yeah.
David Nutter, remember? He would shoot lots and lots of coverage. But you know what? He also had lots of room in the editing room, to Larry's point, for performance and just like tighter, different lenses, different options. And it made it a lot easier in the editing room. That's why he's so good.
Larry knows.
Because I don't necessarily agree with the David Nutter methodology either. I mean, I like to hit and run too, because I like to keep things fresh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Agreed.
We hated it. But that's why he's on Game of Thrones.
But by the way, I mean,
David Masters.
David Nutter is, I mean, he's a genius and a brilliant shooter and
definitely
Game of Thrones. And the guy's got like a record of the most picked up pilots ever. My style and my thought, which again, hopefully will evolve if I ever work again. I'm not sure I want to, but we'll see. But I really liked to do things as realistic and natural as possible. And the way to do that was as little coverage as possible, there were plenty of times it fucked me in the editing room. But if you can count on your actors and you do have a good script, you can get there. But it is a bigger challenge. I was always influenced the way Woody Allen shot a movie Martin Scorsese shot a movie. I'm not comparing myself. I get it.
It sounded like you were comparing.
I get it. I'm not even comparing myself to Kevin Connolly's directing.
You're kind of suggesting that you're in the same boat as those guys.
But I really wanted the show from the get-go. I spoke to about this earlier, but I went to HBO. I said I wanted to shoot in widescreen. They told me I was, who the fuck do I think I am? And I'm pretentious. And I was like, Joey is shooting in widescreen on NBC. Everyone's going to have big TVs. And this show, which I know you guys see as a little low budget piece of crap, I see as a big, beautiful visual, you know, where we're going to shoot LA in a way that you haven't really seen before. And again,
it helped with the walk and talks.
It did. But it did help when you had Larry Charles, when you had David Frankel, who directed the pilot. It helped to get those visions really where we wanted them to go and shoot what we wanted, you know? And that's completely different, which I do want to talk to you about this before you go. But like Sasha, you're doing, I mean, what's going on there? You're walking into rooms and you have no idea what's going to happen, or you have an outline or what? And I'm talking Sasha Baron Cohen. I'm talking Borat, the dictator. Yeah.
Every day was different. Some things we could actually, if I had the ability, I would take the AD the night before, because I never slept when I was doing that movie.
Right.
I was way too anxious all the time. It's like, how is this going to fucking work? I can't see it working, you know? So I would go out the night before, like 3 o'clock in the morning, and try to case the location and kind of try to imagine like, okay, we could put the van here so everybody could jump in and we could run away. We'll have 15 minutes before the police are called. Oh, you know, God. I would think about all the logistics, even as much as the creativity of the scene.
Right.
Because the creativity of the scene, once the scene was rolling, you had to hope for the best, you know? So there was a sense of trying to be one step ahead of everybody. But a lot of times you just had to accept the reality of the situation. You walk into scenes and this is where you're going to shoot and you're going to make the best of it. And see, Entourage, I thought, had an amazing, that you just alluded to this, it had an amazing, unique, and distinctive visual style. You know, it had really nice camera work, great art direction. And what we did was we put these very spontaneous scenes in front of all this very kind of well-photographed, good cinematography.
Stephen Frearberg and some others.
And that juxtaposition was also great. You know, that really worked as a juxtaposition too.
Just back to Sasha for a second. So anyone who's not familiar with those movies and Borat, you're directing these movies. Are you acting? Like, are you almost laughing? Are you fearing for your life during some of these scenes? Like, what's going on there?
There were times when all those things were true. One of the things that I had to do was meet the target before Borat arrived. And I would have a story. I had a name. I had a fake ID. And I, you know, cut my hair and wore a sports coat and a nice shirt, sometimes a tie every day.
Right.
It looked very professorial. And I would say, you know, we're freelance because we only had a few people on the crew also.
Wow.
So I said, look, I'm a freelance journalist. You know, I was hired for the day. And these are my guys. And, you know, I haven't met this guy yet. I think his name is Borat, but I haven't met him. But I understand he doesn't know anything, you know, about America. He's from Kazakhstan. Do you know Kazakhstan? And they go, no, I don't know. Okay, good, good. And, you know, I'd say, yeah, he doesn't know. He doesn't even know what a chair is, you know? And so please be patient with him. Be tolerant if he says the wrong thing. You know, he really doesn't mean it. He's a very good person, you know, and like, and then I would usually do something like, if you've been on TV, you know, you should do a pilot. You know, I'm going to give you my card. And afterwards, we'll talk about maybe doing something else. You know,
Good movie.
That's amazing. You should have had behind the scenes going to see your performances on that, because that's equally amazing to get this stuff going.
Yeah.
As I said with Larry before, it's really living, breathing art. And however you got to the place that you were with me, you had seemingly lost the anxiety of it, which I still have, sadly, at 52 years old. And I don't know that that's ever going to go away. But, you know, it was a great thing. Anyway, Larry, this was honestly amazing. I really do. I miss you. And I have great memories from our time working together. Maybe someday, somehow, we'll do it again.
We'll get a chance to at least hang out in person at some point. But this was really, really fun. I'm really happy to see you guys. I'm happy to hear you, Kevin. Kevin and Doug, it's been great, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Larry. You are the man.
Stay safe, Larry.
Just say hello to everybody for me. I'll talk to you later.
Be good. Anyway, that was fantastic. Seeing Larry Charles again. It's been a while really brought back a lot of memories and a lot of the stresses of the show that he helped iron out and some of a lot of great things. And I forgot to tell him one of my favorite lines was a Larry Charles line, which even broccoli screams when you rip it from the ground.
Great line.
Subtle and genius, and that's what Larry is. So that is it for another episode of Victory the Podcast. I'm Doug Ellen at Mr. Doug Ellen.
I'm Kevin Dillon at Kevin Dillon Official.
Victory!
Action. You know, we sat to flex.
I'm going to let this dog die.